This is an ABC podcast.
I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. A feeling.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. And it's time to dress up because we're going out to look at the nighttime economy. Andreina Sayhouse is doing her doctorate at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. She's an expert on the nighttime economy.
It's a concept that emerged in the 1990s in the United Kingdom, and it emerged as a result of a process of urban revitalization that was going there at the time, and it was associated to this urban renovation processes to bring life back to the cities, and it emerged along with the concept of the idea of the 24-hour city. However, when it comes to more practical terms, the nighttime economy refers to all those social, economic, cultural activities that take place between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. And it's a concept that has been taking a lot of strength and a lot of importance and relevance over the last decade due to the emergence of a new role, which is the role of the night mayors or the night managers around the world.
And here is the very first one.
So my name is Merk Malan. At the moment, I'm a nightlife consultant or a global nightmare advocate. We advise cities, but also brands on their nightlife strategy.
And are you still the Nachtburgermeister?
The Nachtburger, yeah. No, I'm the mayor of Amsterdam helped me to set up the NGO. And I made a promise to him that when it could stand on its own feet and financially and had all the network that I would pass it on. And that moment was beginning of 2018. So we have now a new nightmare in Amsterdam. And I can focus more on what is happening globally.
What's happening globally is that more and more cities are embracing the nighttime economy. And they're doing that because they can smell the money.
So the nighttime economy has not only relevant contributions to its to a city's coffers, but also in terms of jobs. So cities like New York City estimate to contribute around $10 billion to the city's economy. Also in countries like the United Kingdom, where they have carried all kinds of economic studies or measurements of the nighttime economy, they say it creates an average of £66 billion per year in revenue, which supports 1.3 million jobs. Just like in New York City, it supports around 300,000 employees. So we're talking about a very relevant sector and local economy. So it's very easy when cities start carrying out studies to understand the size of their nighttime economies. It's very easy to see the connection between the nighttime economy and local economic development. It's a driver for many activities.
Part of the thinking here is that a city with a vibrant nighttime economy is more appealing to creative young people who work in high-value industries. Merk Malan compared Amsterdam with Boston.
In Boston, although it has, of course, Harvard University, it has a cap on the amount of liquor licenses or establishments, music and nightlife establishments they can have. And you can see that they only have like one-tenth of the amount of tourists coming to that city, but they have a lot of talent. But this talent also moves away straight away after they graduated. If you compare this to Amsterdam, where we have attracting 17 million tourists on a yearly basis, and we have 24-hour public transport instead of Boston that ends at 12 or 12:30. So we came to the conclusion that for a vibrant nightlife, there's three pillars. The first one is the talent or the community. The second one is the space, the venues where these people can perform. And the third pillar is the framework conditions. So the policy that is installed in this city.
And that third one, most cities haven't really considered.
When you think about urban planning as a field, we have to realize that urban planners, architects, designers thought about cities only for the day. We forgot to plan what happens after dark. We forgot to plan how social activity, how economic activity, how different types of activity in the city greatly vary and greatly change when it's dark. And so basically this is an invitation to think about the city in these terms. And I like to talk about the concept of the nighttime economy, but also in broader terms, I like to talk about nighttime planning and design, which is an emerging field that should be taken into consideration not only by mayors and cities around the world, but also from an academic perspective. It's something that is growing very fast in different cities in different contexts.
That isn't to say that there aren't problems. Noise, drunkenness, antisocial behavior, violence.
There are definitely real issues. The question is, how can we plan, how can we prevent these things from happening or mitigate these things in a better way? So an example could be to, for instance, map these activities, to use spatial analysis as a tool to understand the dynamics of the city after dark. I recently did an exercise of mapping the liquor licenses of the city of Boston. There's a cap on the number of liquor licenses. So I mapped where they're located, and I realized that just as in some areas of the city, in some neighborhoods, you have 150 licenses in a very small neighborhood or corridor, then there's entire neighborhoods that have only one or two. So the distribution is completely uneven, which leads to problems such as saturation. So the saturation or the agglomeration of these licenses sometimes aggravates these issues such as noise, such as crime, such as violence. So when we talk about planning, we talk about looking at these issues from a more organized and planned perspective, more proactive perspective, so we can actually shape the way that things happen after dark.
On the money, we're all dressed up and out on the town, looking at the nighttime economy. Peter Miller comes at it from a different angle. He's Professor of Violence Prevention at Deakin University.
Well, I think the nighttime economy, it needs to be defined in whatever you talk about. So it's somewhere around 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. in general. That's what people think about as the nighttime economy. But it's really important to differentiate. We only ever report in three-hour blocks between 6 and 9 p.m. We don't really deal in that world because we deal in violence. 9 to 12 is when most people are entering nighttime entertainment districts. 12 to 3 is when most people are leaving. And 3 to 6 is where the real troopers stay and where a lot of the harm occurs, the disproportionate harm occurs.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes intuitive sense, actually.
It does. So it's problematic when you get a report saying, here's the nighttime economy and here's the benefit of the nighttime economy, but in fact, it's really the dinner time economy because the vast majority of what they're talking about is people having dinner at restaurants.
So if you put aside the dinner time economy and focus on later in the night, what are the costs? Actually, there's a lot.
Short-term or acute policing costs. So you've got police that have to be there. You've got ambulances that have to be there to respond to incidents. You've got emergency department costs. And then you've got other associated costs with actual incidents. These days, you've got costs to councils in terms of CCTV networks and radio networks and all sorts of other measures that have been put in place. And you've also got costs in terms of cleaning up the streets afterwards. You've then got the proactive costs. So, for example, in Geelong, there are four police employed full-time to just deal with licensed venues. So that's all the licensing applications, all of the issues, holding liquor records, those sorts of things. Now, they're not the licensing agency. So then each state has an Office of Liquor Gaming and Racing or a Commission of Liquor Gaming and Racing, and all Victoria has both. So they actually do the licensing and all the compliance checking to make sure your signs are in the right place and that your license is filled in the right way. And these are obviously really substantial costs. Then you have the costs from harm. So, for example, a single fight can result in a person getting an acquired brain injury, and the average cost to the community of an acquired brain injury is $15 million over the lifetime.
There's also the downstream costs of sexual assault and other violence.
The costs go far beyond in terms of long-term health costs, long-term social support costs, and there's huge ripple effects to family members, the psychological harm on them, but even psychological harm on a lot of the emergency worker attendances to something like that. Now, those have been calculated and they are very substantial.
All right. So that is a long, long list, actually, Peter.
We haven't even talked about property loss, property damage. And then the really big costs also come in something like criminal costs. So when you get somebody who's charged with an assault and then the solution of that crime and the way that goes on. Criminal costs are huge. I mean, most of us have had to pay for a lawyer at one stage or another. The costs are massive in that space as well.
So what does this all add up to? Well, it's hard to say.
It was a big study that looked at the ACT in Tasmania, and we did minor costings in relation to alcohol-related crime. So we didn't look at the other alcohol-related elements. We only looked at alcohol-related crime because it was a study into crime. And those figures were small because ultimately the ACT is quite small as well, as you can imagine.
Why don't we know more? Surely we should be looking at the costs in Sydney and Melbourne in particular, but really all of the state capitals would be worth having a look at.
I agree. There's always a number of major problems with that. First, you've got to have government funding that is interested in doing that. So the national government, federal government, state governments put out funding streams and they put in priorities, and none of them have ever put those in as priorities. And then you get a lot of smaller pots of money that can do that. But so far, I haven't tried specifically in that space, but my colleagues have never been successful, and I know they've tried. So it's a case of finding the research funding to do that, but also making sure that it's independent, because that's a big part of the issue with a lot of the so-called research, is that, you know, it has to be assessed independently. You've got to make sure the designs are properly done, and you've got to make sure then that the results are independently reviewed to be accurate. Please don't stop the music.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy, and I look amazing. I'm hitting the clubs because we're all about the nighttime economy. Please don't stop the music. The city that's led the way on this has probably been Amsterdam, which has always attracted tourists to its red light district, bars and coffee houses. But in 2013, nightmare Murrick Milan steered through a change in approach.
And we granted 10 venues with a 24-hour licenses. These venues were not located in the city centre, but more on the outskirts of the city, because the centre is overflown by tourists and definitely also stag parties. So we focused on the quality of the event. Is this venue adding to the cultural offering in Amsterdam? So we said we would really love to have venues that have which are multidisciplinary. So they have a bar, gallery, co-working space. Often one of them even has a gym. Of course, they also have a nightclub, which can get in a lot of talent. But really, I think also at the core of this approach was, is this venue or this pocket of 24-hour economy, is it also serving the community that lives around these venues? Because sometimes you just have a nightclub is two big black doors in your neighborhood. There's like people on the street in the weekend, and then on the Monday there's litter on the street. So how can we incentivize operators to have a better program, to have an offering for the neighborhood during like Monday till Friday? And so they also benefit. And we think like unity through community, by building stronger communities, we'll build better cities.
To do this, the city identified three factors.
First, we looked at the public space. How's the public space set up? For example, we transformed this area into a pedestrian area at night. Cyclists, which we have a lot of them in Amsterdam, couldn't cycle there anymore. Taxis were better organized, but also lighting and also other obstacles. So nobody could park their bicycle anymore on the square. And
is this the Rembrandt plane?
Yes, this is a Rembrandt plane. Yeah, so we took away all the obstacles. The second thing, we installed square hosts. These are social workers. They have got the right training. They know how to deal with people that are intoxicated, etc. And they patrol the street every Friday and Saturday night. They are like the eyes and the ears of the police as well. So they can, if there is like somebody being thrown out of a venue, if there's a little incident happening, they could really see who are the troublemakers, so that if the police comes in, they don't have to be there very long in the district. They don't have to be there with their shiny lights and with their armor and etc. Because this also creates a pretty negative and aggressive atmosphere. The last thing was, again, with how to deal with reports of nuisances. There was an efficient communication between both sides, the community police and the city residents. And like we managed to get down like by 28% the reports of nuisance like in 2 years' time. And I think almost 30% for neighbors that live there and have to deal with it every weekend. I think that has a huge impact.
What about the wider impact on the city's economy?
In Amsterdam, we haven't done an economic impact study on the nighttime economy on its own. I'm advocating for this already for quite a while. I think, I don't know really why they don't want to do it. Maybe because the impact will be too big and otherwise I have even more arguments. But what I do know is that that tourism adds 3.2 billion euros to the local economy every year in Amsterdam. And as you know, like, a lot of these people are using the nighttime economy, because for me, nighttime economy starts at after the other 9 to 5. You know, it starts after people leave their offices and go to restaurants. What was interesting about a report which was came out of Italy, actually, which was done by the tourism board in Rome, is that they asked tourists if they come to a city for the cultural activities, so for the museums and for the squares, etc., or that they come for the vibrancy, so for markets and restaurants and that kind of places. So, and out of this report came that number one was actually the cultural vibrancy.
So far, all this feels a bit underdone in the economic analysis department, but Andrew Licence is here to help. His consultancy Ingenium looked at the nighttime economy in 88 Australian urban centres, starting with what he calls the core.
This kind of covers those businesses really that operate sort of after 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., so kind of the evening and the nighttime, that provide those kind of entertainment and leisure services really. So, you know, you're talking your bars, your pubs, your restaurants, theatres, live music, those kind of things really. So that was like our kind of key starting point. And from there, we kind of undertook a supply chain mapping exercise, really, to try and work out what other industries kind of feed into the core. We look at, you know, things like public transport, hotels, police, the health services, those kind of things. And we refer to those as the non-core. So they may not operate kind of fully during the nighttime, but they provide those support services to the core, if that makes sense.
What are you finding, Andrew?
In the most recent research that we carried out, we found that the core nighttime economy generates around $127 billion in turnover for that year, which is around 4% of all Australian turnover. So it's quite a sizable sector. In addition to that, it employs around almost 1.1 million people, which is a slightly higher proportion, about 9%.
That is bigger than I thought it would be. Can you break those down into sectors? Because I'm guessing, you said earlier, you know, one thinks of restaurants and pubs and nightclubs and music venues. Can we break it down into those sorts of things?
Yeah, so we generally, our core kind of nighttime economy definition, we kind of break down into drink, entertainment and food. Food accounts for around 2/3 of that employment and about half of the turnover. So I think entertainment is a bit larger, so it's about 30% of establishments and turnover. Whereas drink establishments account for about 10% of the wider core NTE.
We're up all night to the sun. We're up all night to get some. We're up all night for good fun. We're up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get lucky.
Andrew Licence's work is for the Council of Lord Mayors. So which local body's king of the night?
Sydney's definitely number one. I mean, in terms of density, you're looking at about 180 establishments per square kilometre, whereas I think the next nighttime economy down is probably coming close to about half the amount per square kilometre. Yeah, so I think Sydney's top.
That is despite what have been controversial lockout laws in Sydney.
That's right. I think it has shown some growth in the last year, I would say, but the introduction of the laws kind of had a bit of a negative impact, I think, on the business base. And we saw actually quite a large decline, really, from the period 2014 to 15 of about 8% of the business base kind of dropping off. Even though the growth in the most recent years is quite strong, it's off the back of a quite hefty decline, really.
Was that more than normal? It can be hard to make a go of those sorts of businesses, and there's plenty of businesses that fail every year.
If you look at the trend prior to the introduction of the laws, there was quite a kind of strong growth over the last 5 years, kind of up to the period of 2013. So it does seem kind of out of sort. The trend from 14 onwards, when the laws were introduced, does seem kind of at odds with prior trends. But it was showing quite strong growth, but then has kind of died off slightly. But so it seems to be recovering now.
There's a campaign to roll back the lockout laws, and some feeling that the New South Wales state government, which has already backflipped on a couple of issues, might do it. Nighttime economy consultant, Mirak Malan.
If Sydney can turn it around and focus more on the quality nightlife scene, have proper policies in place, I think they can definitely turn it around. But the biggest problem, I think, is the image, because people also read articles. And to get that global image of Sydney being a vibrant city back again, that will definitely be an issue. Definitely in this district, the King's Cross district, I think it was also a mobility issue to start with. Because when you have lack of mobility and you have a lot of people coming out, leaving the venues all at 3 a.m., then you will definitely have a lot of issues. So good mobility scheme is crucial for a safe and vibrant nightlife.
Safe and vibrant. Okay. So how do we reduce harm?
If you want to try to reduce alcohol-related harm, and the evidence has been shown again and again in terms of Newcastle and Sydney, you cease the service of alcohol in the later hours. So 3 a.m. tends to be an hour that people choose. That seems to be a reasonably acceptable hour to the public. But basically, for every hour after midnight, you get about, on average, a 15% increase in assaults, injuries, and emergency department attendances. My job is to figure out the numbers, and then it's government's job to figure out how much they want to see harm reduced. There are lots of other ways in which you can reduce harm. There's usually the industry claims, well, we should educate people, we should teach them about personal responsibility. That's never worked. It's never going to work because, by definition, alcohol consumption and intoxication means that the first part of the brain that shuts down is the prefrontal cortex. That's also the part that processes education. And the more intoxicated we get, the simpler we act and the more we go back to our very core child-like personalities. Most of us regulate our behaviour. So education doesn't work for that simple reason. The point of intoxication is to behave differently to the way we do when we're sober.
Andreina Sayhaus, who co-authored A Guide to Managing Your Nighttime Economy, says when you suppress people's behaviour, it leads to more problems.
Historically, many cities around the world have taken the approach of imposing a curfew as a solution to these negative activities or results that happen at night. And a city like Bogota, one of the biggest cities in Latin America, imposed a very tough curfew in the 1990s when it was one of the most dangerous cities around the world. And as a result of this curfew, what happened? So not only nighttime activity was displaced to the outskirts of the city, forcing people to drive longer hours, which also led to greater road accidents, but also it led to the emergence of illegal nightlife activities. So now you have a series of bars, a series of clubs that operate illegally, because it's very difficult to suppress the social activities and the cultural activities that happen at night. Instead of suppressing them, the premise is to try to accommodate them in a more organized, in a more proactive way.
But Peter Miller is confident that restrictions not only make people safer, they're actually good for the nighttime economy.
In fact, if you have a look at some of the reports out there, you'll see that Newcastle, for example, because of shutting at 3 a.m. or stopping service at 3 a.m., shutting at 3:30, has increased the number of liquor licenses it has, the amount of money that's going through those liquor licenses, and they diversified. So what crucially happened was less vertical drinking, much more small bars, much more interest in entertainment rather than intoxication, and food became a big part. And as soon as you can get somebody eating when they go out, that's when the revenues go up a lot. Nighttime economies are, always have been, and always will be a really important part, and having a vibrant one is an important part for any city. It makes it attractive to the young people who live there primarily. Most tourists don't travel somewhere for nighttime economy. The studies we're doing in Queensland and other places show that, in fact, you know, the vast majority of the money from tourism comes from families, people expending money in that way. But it's an important part of cities. So again, that key issue is what's the right balance? Not can you stay open for 24 hours? Is that a goal unto itself?
On The Money today, we're looking at the nighttime economy, which means going out after dark for food, a drink, or entertainment. Cities around the world are encouraging it, and it's not hard to figure out why. Andrew Lysons.
It's growing at a comparable rate, or sometimes even faster rate. So, for example, in terms of employment, the sector has grown by about 3.7% in the last year, compared to 2.7% in the wider economy. And similarly, the turnover as well is growing 3.1% in the last year, which is kind of well above the rate of inflation. Yeah, there's a lot of increasing interest in this sector in Australia and internationally as well. So yeah, I think it's an exciting time really for the sector. There's a lot of opportunity to grow and also diversify as well, because there's kind of a lot of the right stakeholders coming together to help ensure that there's a vibrant future for the sector, but also like a safe future as well.
Safety is what a professor of violence prevention is all about. So what's the way forward?
The first thing is you need proper monitoring. It's got to be independent to know what the situation is. From there, the community and all sides of the community need to debate this, though you've got to be very careful as soon as you include the alcohol industry in discussions, as with tobacco or gambling industry, generally everything tends to get washed down. So usually it's important to keep them out of the policy-making part of health policy in particular. But you get, as politicians, people can then make decisions about the levels of harm that are acceptable and the cost and benefit to community. Now, remember, most of the reports that we see out there from social research companies and people like that don't actually talk about the cost to the community or the benefit to the community. They talk about the overall financial benefit. But a lot of that goes to very large hotel groups and nightclub owners. That doesn't necessarily flow back into the community other than a few part-time jobs.
What's clear is that if our local politicians are going to make decisions about the nighttime economy, and they are, more information would be helpful for us and for them.
The most important thing I would say is to have data. That's one of the most difficult aspects when it comes to nighttime economy. I think the first thing a city should do is to try to understand what's the size of its nighttime economy and what's the vocation of its nighttime economy. For some cities, a vocation has to do with retail. For others, it has to do with culture. For others, it has to do with gastronomy. So that's the first step definitely to take. One additional thing that cities should look at is try to understand which are the stakeholders or the people involved in the nighttime ecosystem. So nightlife, it's more than just bars. It's more than just isolated activities. It's part of a bigger platform that involves many actors. There's an emerging role of what's been called the night mayors, the night managers, the night czars, which are people that are being appointed by cities all over the world to act as mediators between these different stakeholders, which is interesting because it's a way to recognize that the nighttime economy and the nighttime in general in the city needs special attention, and that we can no longer improvise when it comes to what happens in cities after dark.
Thanks to consultant and doctoral student Andreina Sehaus, also Andrew Licence from Ingenium Research, Professor of Violence Prevention at Deakin University Peter Miller, and Merrick Milan, former Nightmare of Amsterdam. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.